in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two sports-related interviews for you today. In the first, we will learn how the great sport of golf came to America. In the second, we'll be looking back at the early days of baseball. Here's part one. Well, fans of the game of golf can learn something about the history of the game, particularly the history of how golf really emerged in importance here in the United States through a new book which has just been published by Rounder Books in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The book is called Golf Links, Che Burgess, Francis Ouimet, and the Bringing of Golf to America. And the author of this book is Charles D. Burgess, who is the great-grandson of really the central figure in this story. A brilliant golfer and brilliant golf instructor who played such a central role in the bringing of golf to America and the fostering of some of the most important talents of young golfers early in the 20th century. And Charles D. Burgess, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much, Greg. It's my pleasure to be here.
I have kind of a advanced copy of your book, which does not, at least at a glance, include too much in the way of a biography about you, but I have a feeling that with the name that you have and the obvious interest in golf, you must be something of a golfer yourself.
Well, I'm an ardent golfer. My handicap is not where I'd like it, as most golfers are, but I certainly enjoy the game and was raised with golf as part of my legacy.
Right. And of course, one of the things you're doing here is in a sense, righting a wrong by bringing before the public the name of your great-grandfather, who was such a significant figure, but a figure whose importance is not properly respected and remembered. And also his first prize student, who did so much to ignite interest in the game of golf here in America. One thing you mentioned in the preface is something of about a long-forgotten letter that was found among your great-grandfather's writings and papers and archives and so on. Tell us about that and its significance.
Well, the significance dates back to the fact that when my great-grandfather retired from active golf participation, he actually was living in a small cottage near the Woodland Golf Course where he had been pro for over 30 years. And in that small cottage in the attic was a trunk full of his memorabilia and press clippings that dated back to, you know, back to Scotland. And unfortunately, in the rush to tear down that small dwelling, the bulldozers came before the family could retrieve the artifacts, and they were buried, crushed, or lost forever.
Mm.
And a lot of those things were the key elements to Che's role in the development of American golf, and they were, I retraced them, studiously going to archives all over the world, in Scotland and in America, to find some of the original documents that documented Che's role in golf. And when I conducted this search, one of my aunt said, there might be something here you'd like to take a look at, Chuck, and sure enough, it was a handwritten letter from Francis Ouimet that had been in her bureau drawer for 50 or 60 years. And in that letter, Francis gave full credit to his mentor and really gave me impetus to go ahead and say that, you know, gee, this might be a significant story and make a book.
Mm, very good. One of the points that is made very early on in the book is that the origins of the game of golf itself are shrouded in a bit of mystery. But certainly there's no mystery about the fact that Scotland has really been the country most closely associated with its emergence, even if we don't know exactly when or exactly where the game of golf was born. But it's intriguing, a game that is around us now that we just utterly take for granted. It's interesting to think that we really have no clear idea of just who created it and when.
The most famous figure, of course, in golf history is probably old Tom Morris of St. Andrews, who many people credit as the inventor or the father of golf. But, of course, no one person could be credited with that. Golf is a game that evolved. And as I said in detailed in the book, there are many ways that it may have occurred. It could have started in Europe. It could have been with those seaside shepherds with their crooks turned upside down, hitting a rock or a hardened piece of sheep dung towards some holes to pass the time. But as the modern game of golf evolved, the most prominent figure in Scotland was, of course, old Tom Morris. And interestingly, old Tom Morris had a hand in mentoring Che Burgess, who grew up in Montrose, Scotland, not far from St. Andrews.
Golf was not his only sport. You tell us about his very impressive exploits on the football field as well. And, of course, we're talking about European-style football, which over here we call soccer. But this proved to be also a very significant avenue of pursuit for your great-grandfather and something which generated all kinds of success for him, both then and later in life.
It's interesting that both the modern game of golf and association football, or soccer as we call it today, developed about the same time in Europe and in the United Kingdom particularly. And Che was a gifted athlete. He was a prodigy. He was trained as a stonemason, actually. He was apprenticed as a stonemason at the early age of 11. But his talents for both football and golf became apparent, and he was mentored. Che had a professional career playing for some of the biggest teams and internationally for Scotland and England. And before he settled down to his career in golf, which began in 1903.
Hmm. We're speaking with Charles D. Burgess, and his book is called Golf Links. Your great-grandfather returned to the game of golf just at that moment in time when golf was really becoming a still more popular game, and there was, in your words, a marked increase in the demand for the services of golf professionals. And and this was a game which was starting to take hold here in the United States and due in no small measure to the exploits of someone by the name of Alex Findlay. Tell us a little bit about him.
Alex Findlay is another one of the forgotten pioneers of golf in America, and I felt it incumbent to put his story in the book because it's so closely woven with Che's story. They both came from Montrose, Scotland, and Findlay was a bit of an adventurer. Came to America as actually a cowboy. He had a friend from Montrose that had a cattle ranch out in Nebraska. And in 1887 or 86, Findlay went out there to join his friend and decided one day to play golf. He brought along his golf clubs and his gutta-percha ball, and to his dismay, of course, there was no golf courses in America anywhere at the time. So he set out and actually set out a small six-hole course out in the plains of Nebraska, which could be interpreted as one of the first, if not the first, golf links in America. Findlay later went on to be an important architect and designed over 100 golf courses in America, including the most famous resorts on the east coast of Florida. As Henry Flagler put the trains down to Florida after the turn of the century, Findlay was his golfer-in-chief. So he designed courses, the Breakers, Palm Beach, Ormond, St. Augustine, and even one in Nassau in the Bahamas. So Findlay was an important golf architect, and he was also an important promoter of the game.
You call him a Johnny Appleseed for golf.
Yeah, he went to all over the country. He even went as far as Mexico to sow his golf stories and his gospel of golf and created these courses wherever he went.
It's interesting when you think about some of the great things he went on to accomplish, that when we think about that first little golf course of six holes in 1887, in which you you mentioned him using tin cans on the ground. I mean, that was that's how humble this first little golf course was.
I can imagine what the locals must have thought of this fellow out in the middle of these rolling sand hills in Nebraska with the knickers and this strange-looking implement hitting a little white ball across the plains with a the buffalo once trod.
Hmm. You mentioned that Boston quickly becomes an important center for interest in golf in America. Why was that?
Well, there were a number in Chicago and the Midwest was important, but Boston became central to it because of its proximity, of course, to Europe. The Scottish immigrants would come in either to New York or to Boston. In what was called the Scottish Invasion, the golf professionals that came over here at the turn of the century. And incidentally, the book itself was designed not only to honor my great-grandfather, Che Burgess, but he was very representative of the many, many golf professionals who were the unsung heroes of American golf, the men behind the champions, the men who taught America the game. And many of them settled in the Boston area, and from that area very quickly, with the advent of Francis Wee Metz's incredible victory in 1913, it became one of the central locations for the development of golf, with the number of golf courses that were established, and also the celebrity students that came from that area.
Your great-grandfather goes on to achieve some stunning success as a golfer. At a time when there were other very, very great golfers at play, at some point he began pursuing the possibility of teaching golf. It's, I think, in 1905 and 1906 that he first begins establishing a reputation of not only being able to play the game of golf very well, but to teach it to others.
That happened, of course, in Scotland. He was only the second ever professional at one of the oldest golf courses in the world, the Royal Montrose Golf Course, as it's known today. At the time, which is simply called the Montrose Golf Course. And, he was a contemporary of the great triumvirate of Harry Vardon and all of the which contained Harry Vardon and he, of course, was tutored by old Tom Morris. So he played against Europe's best golfers and did all right, but he found that his forte really was being able to get novice golfers accustomed to the game very quickly. And he had a style and a temperament that made him an ideal teacher.
Hmm.
And that's where he focused his career.
One disappointment comes with his rather surprising and abrupt dismissal from Royal Albert, where he was, he would have been the resident professional there, and it sounds like you were never really able to uncover just why he was dismissed. But in the wake of that disappointment, then a door opens, which eventually brings your great-grandfather to America.
It was an incredible series of events. When I researched the book in Scotland and in Montrose, I was actually handed the handwritten records of the Royal Albert Golf Course, which was akin to me holding the Constitution of the United States. It was just an amazing document to have in my hands, and they were just so generous in letting me research it. And apparently, at the time, that was the course of the wealthy, the aristocratic members of society, where Che had a working-class background, as did all of the golf professionals. And in the book, there is, throughout the book, the conflict in the early years between the working-class professional golfers and the wealthy amateurs who controlled the game. So for reasons that are speculated on in the book, Che was dismissed after 5 years of wonderful service with the club, but that dismissal did not stop him from being one of Montrose's greatest golfers. He was reinstated as an amateur and went on to set a new course record. And then his good friend Alex Findlay came back from America and said to him, Che, this unparalleled opportunities in America. The game is taking hold there. We need professionals of your caliber to come over and teach America the game. And after considering the proposal by Findlay. Che got on a boat with his wife and young son and emigrated to America.
And it's really an amazing story from that point on. And one of the things you mentioned, too, is that he remained at Woodland, where he was given a position as golf professional. He remained there for 35 years. And in this life of golf pros, that was really exceptional longevity and really said something about your great-grandfather's character and his sense of loyalty.
It was extraordinary for the time. There was this, of course, was before the Professional Golfers Association of America was formed. So these golfers that came over at that time had absolutely no sort of security or a union or anything to protect their interests, and they were totally at the mercy of whichever club hired them. And many of the early pros would last a year or two and then would move on, and they were sort of like vagabonds going all across America trying to get hold and find a good situation. Che's situation was very unique. And it served as an example, and I think the stability and his nature and his character led to his role in the eventual organization of the professionals, particularly in New England, and you know, the better relationships between the amateur golfing establishment and the professionals who work for them.
You said the class distinctions which existed to some extent in Great Britain were in some respects even more pronounced here in America, where golf at that point in time really was limited only to the wealthiest of citizens.
That's exactly right. In Scotland and in Europe, the links lands where the game evolved, they were public lands. And although there were golfing societies that would set up clubhouses along the links land, the links themselves were public property. So even the poorest of youth could get on there and have a round of golf with the local aristocrats. In America, when the game evolved, there were no public golf courses, no public lands on which the game evolved, and the game was established by the wealthy at their country clubs, which in those days had things like polo and racing and, you know, outings and so on. And then they eventually established golf courses there, or they built them, which of course took a lot of money to develop a golf course. So golf was not a game of the average man at the turn of the century. It was a game of the wealthy, and these Scottish pros were hired by them and treated oftentimes like a servant, would take their meals in the kitchens with the help, and were not allowed to socialize with the members in the clubhouse in the early years. And they were simply here to teach the game, and they had no social life or no professional organization to protect their interests.
The moment that that really changes most dramatically in terms of golf being a game for the wealthy is when your great-grandfather takes in hand a very, very gifted high school youth from the area by the name of Francis Uimet. And this is a young man from very humble circumstances, exactly the kind of person who had no reason to ever dream of playing a serious round of golf. And of course, he goes on to a success which ignited a frenzy of interest and affection across the country. Tell us what he managed to accomplish in 1913 and what made it so significant.
When my great-grandfather came to America, he discovered this young caddy playing on the course. Francis Uimet was his name, the son of a gardener from nearby Brookline, Massachusetts. And he noticed an extraordinary talent in the young man and took him under his wing and gave him lessons for free. Of course, he played with him. He had one day off a week. That was Sunday. And Che would take Francis out to play golf every Sunday for the next 5 years until he was sufficiently prepared to enter national competitions. And Francis was a relatively unknown 20-year-old ex-caddy from the working class who was entered into the 1913 U.S. Open against the world's greatest golfers, Harry Vardon and Ted Ray at the time, and a host of British golfers. An American amateur had never won this country's Open until that time, and Francis made a tremendous run at the championship, and in dramatic fashion over rain-soaked fairways and a Hollywood story setting, managed to wind up tying the two great Britishers and forced a playoff, a three-way playoff, and won the U.S. Open in 1913. And the interest that developed in that, there was a frenzy as each round went on and this young amateur was making a run at the championship. It was akin to the coverage of a Super Bowl today, or almost like Miracle on Ice, the 1980 U.S. Olympic team's victory over the Soviets. So great was the difference in the talent level perceived, and so that when we met one, it was probably the greatest upset in sporting history to the day.
Hmm. You mentioned, too, that even before play had started, there was already a great deal of anticipation. You say more so than any other single American sporting event up to that time, because there was this amazing array of celebrity golfers that were going to be part of this. And so already there's a fair number of eyes watching this competition. But then as this unheralded young American begins to score such stunning success round after round, the attention only escalated from there. And as you say, that changed everything, Francis Ouimet's victory in this tournament. It changed everything about the way Americans looked at golf.
One young a perfect example of that would be a young caddy that was down in New York, and he was reading the news, and he heard it. In those days, there was no radio or television, of course, so everything was by the newspapers and magazines. And he read the news, and the news filtered down that this ex-caddy just won the U.S. Open, and this other caddy couldn't believe it. His name was Gene Sarazen, and he decided on that moment that he, too, was going to pursue golf. And we all know the wonderful success that men like Gene Sarazen from the working class had and their effect on professional golf and golf for both amateurs and professionals.
Hmm. This Francis Ouimet was, of course, the ideal person for the moment, not only because his very background made him such an inspiring success story, but also the fact that from everything you tell us, he was an incredibly humble, gracious competitor. And you tell us even a very poignant story about the little boy who served as his caddy for that 1913 Open tournament, and the beautiful gesture which Francis Ouimet makes the morning of that dramatic final day playoff.
The little caddy's name was Eddie Lowry. He was a 10-year-old caddy from Woodland. He was skipping school, but he assured Francis that he wasn't going to get in trouble for doing that. And they made a very incongruous-looking pair. Francis looked like a caddy himself walking down the fairway, and he had this little diminutive 10-year-old by his side through the pouring rain and so on. And it was almost comical to look at the two because Francis was very tall and lean, and little Eddie was 10 years old carrying this giant bag. The bag was as big as himself. And when the playoff came, one of Francis's friends, a very experienced golfer, offered to take the bag for the last playoff because at that point he felt that, well, perhaps Francis needed a little bit more support, a little more advice perhaps from his caddy. And little Eddie was crestfallen and just had a tear in his eye thinking that Francis sure would probably leave him behind. Francis absolutely refused to do that. He looked at his friend and said, no, thank you. Little Eddie will do just fine. And off they went to march together down the fairways towards golf history.
Hmm. Eddie goes on to be a pretty good golfer himself and a respected sports writer. And Francis Ouimet goes on to a fine career, which also includes, as if this wasn't enough of a storybook story, also a very inspiring comeback many, many years later at a point in time when he was considered to be way past his prime. He is able to once again win the National Amateur Championship, which was such a highly prized title for a golfer like Francis Ouimet.
I think that perhaps, in my opinion anyway, is a better indicator of Francis's personality and style than even his tremendous win as a youth. He and Che Burgess were both very humble men, and a lot of this bit of history has been lost because there was no publicity or self-serving statements made by either of the men. So the facts had to speak for themselves. And what happened was in 1931, Che had still been working with Francis. Francis had matured now. It was 17 years since his last major victory. And he had run up against the likes of Bobby Jones and the other younger golfers who had won the National Amateur Championship. And Francis always came in second or third. He was always in the running but never could do it. And in 1913, he was doing very well, and Che knew that he had a real good shot at this year's championship. And he went out to Chicago to the Beverly course, and he insisted that Che accompany him in a wonderful gesture. Again, this is the beginning of the Depression, and Che probably wouldn't have been able to afford to go out there himself, but Francis insisted that he go and accompany him, and he wanted his counsel on the course. So they went out to Chicago, and in every round, Francis faced a younger opponent, someone who the odds were great that younger opponent was going to knock off Francis. And in every round, it was match play golf, he would survive just barely. But the strangest thing happened. Francis was playing tremendous golf, and he'd sink a 20-footer or a 30-footer, or even in one case, a 50-foot putt. And the applause from the crowd was minimal. For some reason, they just weren't pulling for him. And then finally, on the last day of competition, he was head-to-head with a young challenger from Chicago, and the crowd suddenly changed their mind. And there was this groundswell that Francis was finally going to do it. And sure enough, hole by hole, he fought his way, and he captured the 1931 U.S. Amateur and made this tremendous comeback. And all the time, it just was the most humble and self-effacing man you could imagine. And when he returned to his home, he did nothing but give credit to others, including Che Burgess, for his comeback victory. He's a tremendous, tremendous man.
There is so much that takes us back in this book, and we should mention that in the pages of it, we find out about your great-grandfather's connection to well-known figures like Babe Ruth and Bing Crosby. We just have a minute or so left. I understand from what you told me before the interview that you actually had the privilege of knowing your great-grandfather.
I did. I was a teenager when he passed away, and part of my interest, of course, in golf came from the many stories he told me himself, and the many celebrities that, as a young boy, was fascinated by. Yeah, there's stories about how he taught Babe Ruth the game of golf, how Bing Crosby, who was one of his intimates and often took lessons from him, and the fact that he created not only We Met, but two other national champions. He mentored the great Jesse Gilford, who won the National Amateur in 1921, and Ted Bishop, who was the first amateur national champion after World War II. So the remarkable career of Che Burgess spanned decades, and all along the way he was helping people with golf. And even his football career extended into the United States, because on the off season from golf in the early years, he was Harvard University's first coach of soccer, and actually brought the Crimson to two back-to-back national championships in 1913 and 1914. He's a remarkable man.
No kidding. And it's proven over and over again in the pages of this book called Golf Links, written by his great-grandson, Charles D. Burgess, and published by Rounder Books of Cambridge, Massachusetts. Charles D. Burgess, I congratulate you on this job well done. And somewhere your great-grandfather's looking down, very pleased and proud. And I thank you for joining us today on The Morning Show to talk about your book.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg.
I'm excited to be reconnecting with best-selling author Kostya Kennedy, who was my guest for the morning show to talk about a very important book of his called Lasting Impact, One Team, One Season, and What Happens When Our Sons Play Football, a very interesting book about the risks of football, and but also the strong hold that it has over a large swath of the American public, including plenty of young people who want to play this game despite its risks. And I'm reconnecting now with Kostya Kennedy to talk about his latest book, which is actually published by Sports Illustrated, titled The Story of Baseball in 100 Photographs. It is a marvelous book that celebrates the sport of baseball in very striking fashion by presenting an array of 100 different photographs, many of which capture some of the most important superstars of the game and or critical moments in baseball history. And some of these photographs, on the other hand, capture moments that are, in a sense, much more ordinary and everyday, but help illuminate the public's love of baseball and the special hold that this sport has on so much of the public. It's beautifully done, and I'm excited to be able to speak with Kostya Kennedy about this collection from Sports Illustrated again, The Story of Baseball in 100 Photographs. Kostya Kennedy, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks so much, Greg. It's great to be on with you.
I'm really impressed with this book. You wrote the foreword to it. Is that your primary involvement in this book, or did you have any hand in the selection of these actual 100 photographs?
No, actually, I did write the foreword, as you mentioned. I was the editor of the book throughout. So I, of course, with a team, with a photo editor and a designer and a couple of other people, but we selected the photos and tried to weave together a bit of a narrative, photograph by photograph, of this wonderful game.
Right. You've made great selections, and we'll talk about some of the specific choices in just a moment. I wonder if you could maybe expand on a really great quote that you include from someone who was a former colleague of yours at Sports Illustrated for about a quarter of a century, Ronald Modra, who says, "When you're shooting baseball, you're waiting. You're waiting and you're attentive." Explain how, especially once upon a time, being a photographer for the game of baseball was in such large measure a waiting game.
Yeah, it's a wonderful quote, and I included that in the foreword of the book because it sums up a lot of the challenge. Ron's a wonderful photographer. I was able, as a senior writer at Sports Illustrated for a long time, and we'd be on stories together. You know, in baseball, perhaps more than any other mainstream sport, you don't know really where the action's going to be, particularly in the field, right? You can get a pitcher in his windup. You know you can get a batter in his stance. But if you're looking for a great fielding play in particular, or a play at the base, it's often difficult to know. There's no way to know where it's going to happen. So you have to get a little lucky. And baseball, as we know, you know, what Ron said about taking photographs is also a little bit of what we do as consumers and viewers and those of us who love the game. There are moments of intense action that are very quick, and then you're sort of waiting to see what develops in between. So as he mentioned, when he was shooting the Yankees, for example, in the late 70s and early 80s, when the Yankees were in the field, he would often just train his camera on Greg Nettles, who played third base and was a wonderfully acrobatic and elegant fielder at third base, and he felt he had a good chance of getting a good picture if the ball was hit to him. Now, of course, the ball's only hit to him a few times a game, so it's a risk-reward situation, but he felt, and other photographers who I spoke to felt, that when you're shooting baseball, if you spend a day there and you get one or two really good or even great photographs of the kind that sort of elevate outside the game, it's been a great day, and that's what you can hope for.
Right. I really appreciate some of what you explain in the introduction to the book about how these 100 photographs were selected and how this is, for one thing, by no means the 100 most famous baseball photographs. In a sense, although that would be a great book, but I don't think that would be nearly as interesting a book as this book is, which certainly does have its share of famous photographs from baseball. But that's not all this is. This book is more than that. Explain a little further what went into your thinking process, you and those who helped you select these 100 photographs.
Yeah, it was a big challenge, right? And you start off with the challenge of getting 100 photographs, and you could take it in any number of directions, of course, as you're suggesting in your question. So baseball's about to turn 150. The first openly professional baseball team with the Red Stockings in 1869, and we were using this opportunity and are using it to try to tell a narrative of the game, truly to tell a story of baseball over time and over players and over context and over shifts in the game and, of course, over sometimes intersections with the American society at large. So we had sort of a high threshold of what would get in. Of course, the picture had to look pleasing. It had to be aesthetically beautiful or compelling in some way. I wanted pictures to be those that you could stay with a little bit or you could come back to and maybe see something new or see something in a different light. So there was some depth to a photograph. And then also there was content was crucial, meaning that it would wanted to tell a little bit of a story, have a person who is important to the game there or a game itself or a time or, you know, whether it's showing a bullpen cart because of what an important part of the game that was for a little period in the 70s or whatever it might be. So we're trying to tell over the whole a narrative and have the pictures connect in some way to their time and to the overall story of the game. I should just mention briefly, with each picture we have about 250 words of text or so, we hope evocative text, which give a little background and context, a little bit extra to the photograph so people can really dig in and understand what's happening and what they're looking at.
Right. And I also appreciate the fact that the book is separated by time period. So, for instance, the first section of the book is titled Beginnings, appropriately enough, and spans the years 1869 to 1919. And there are some very, very fascinating pictures in this section that include some early luminaries of the game, including Cy Young and Ty Cobb caught in action. I actually would love to have you say just a quick word about a photograph in this section, which you headline Beginning of the World. This is a photograph taken in Boston in the fall of 1903, and it is a remarkable image indeed.
Yes, it's a picture of the first World Series games at a place called Huntington Avenue Grounds in Boston, and it's a big, widespread shot. There weren't that you mentioned the Ty Cobb picture from 1910, which was a beautiful action picture. There wasn't that much action in those days as what people shot, but this was not action, but a big, wide angle looking at the field. And what's so remarkable about it is you see all the people who've come to watch the game, and they're just crowding in. They're on the outfield. They're standing on the big slatted wooden fence. They're packed in to see this incredible spectacle, and very close to the field, as one can see, much closer than you would ever have people today. Obviously, you wouldn't have people on the field at all today, but it's an incredible photograph, I think, because it evokes such a time. It evokes the excitement of this new game. It's relatively new. It's 1903. This is the first World Series. Shows so many people there, so close to the game. You can see people aren't. You understand by looking at this picture that people don't hit the ball as far as they do now in those days, because you wouldn't be able to have people so encroached. So there's a lot about it, along with period advertisement signs for a local shoe shop and things like that, which really make it a powerful picture to look at, I think.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you made mention of the fact that we have very few true action shots from the early years of baseball, which makes the image, for instance, of Ty Cobb all the more precious. It's well, you describe it, this wonderful photograph that captures Ty Cobb and his greatness.
Yeah, so he's coming really hard into third base, basically almost barreling over the third baseman. You see the his foot hitting the bag. It's such, again, these pictures become so revealing. You can see that the bag is kind of a soft bag. It's almost a pillow. It's changed a lot over time. And there's dirt flying everywhere. The umpire in the background is looking to make his call on the play. Cobb has an expression of great intensity on his face. And it's an amazing picture because, of course, it's Ty Cobb, right? And we're seeing him in 1910 and at the height of his powers and what he was as the greatest player in the game at that time. And as we were saying, it's also very rare in those days to see action like this. This really stood out. There are some beautiful pictures from that time, like the World Series one we just described, but often the player pictures are portraits on the sideline of a pitcher going into his windup, perhaps, or a batter taking a little bit of a swing. The action photography didn't really begin until the 20s, 30s, and then more so in the 40s and 50s. It was much harder to get because of the quality of camera in those days, and it was just not in vogue, really, to do it nearly as much as it would become.
Right. We're speaking with Kostya Kennedy, the editor of a wonderful new book from Sports Illustrated called The Story of Baseball in 100 Photographs. I know people will greedily devour the chapter that covers 1920 to 1947, and you title it From Ruth to Robinson. In many ways, that title is all that we need to hear, although there are a whole lot of other luminaries from this period of the game who are captured here as well. I want to just ask you about the photograph that you chose of Babe Ruth. I mean, as you just said, by this point, photography had advanced to the point where there are just countless possibilities, yeah, in terms of great photographs of the wonderful Babe Ruth in action. But I love the photo that you selected, although I've never seen it before. Explain what led you to choose it.
Yeah, so as you say, a player like Ruth or DiMaggio or later on Pete Rose or any number of players, there are many choices you could make. One thing to remember is, so say something like Babe Ruth called shot in the 1932 World Series. There's not really a great picture of it, right? There's a little tiny, grainy image, but there's not a picture that you would even consider including in a book of great photography or as something to really hold up at a good size. But there are many, many pictures of Ruth in many different ways. We chose the picture where he's finishing his mighty swing. You see him sort of in full power. His hips are swiveled. The back of his leg is extended. His front leg, his right leg is bent, and his bat is high on the follow-through. He just hit a home run. He's looking up at it. Both the catcher, who's risen from his crouch, and the umpire also following the flight path of the ball. And you also see the shadows on the dirt there, the shadows of both Ruth and the catcher behind him. It's at Sportsman Park in St. Louis, where Babe and a lot of other people hit quite well against the Browns in those days. And it just seemed you were really seeing Babe Ruth doing what he did. Obviously, he did so many other things, and he was a big, larger-than-life star outside the game, and the way he was so jovial and the raconteur and all that, and also did so much on the field. He could run well, and he was obviously a great pitcher. He did so much well. But the thing that he did, obviously, was hit home runs. And here you're seeing him, the power of Babe Ruth on just, you know, on just a day in October in 1926, and it's one of his home runs, and it really seemed to encapsulate with this picture to tell the larger story of who Babe Ruth was and what he did for the game.
I love this photograph so much. This whole section is peppered with superstars from Joe DiMaggio to Ted Williams to the legendary Satchel Paige. I really appreciate the thoughtful choice you made to capture the great Lou Gehrig. This is another photograph I've never seen before. I've seen ones like it. There are all kinds of photographs from this powerful, poignant moment when Lou Gehrig bade farewell to the game he loved so much. But describe to our listeners the photograph that is here, and again, why you thought this was the perfect photograph to include.
So it's Lou at Yankee Stadium on July 4th, 1939, and he's on the field with several microphones set up on tripods in front of him, and he's delivering the speech that we've come to know and has made its way into the American lexicon of the luckiest man speech, where he knows that he has ALS, and he's still says he considers himself the luckiest man on the face of the earth. It's a powerful picture for what you see in Lou with his head slightly bent. He's not actually speaking. He's in pause at that moment. And also the men you see behind him looking at him and understanding the courage that they're seeing. Here, the case, you know, Lou Gehrig was an all-time, obviously, great, great, great ball player. There are plenty of pictures of him hitting or fielding or doing something that we could have shown. But what Lou Gehrig did in the way he faced this disease and in his bravery and composure, really slipped the bounds of the game. And there aren't as many times as one would think that baseball does that. Of course, it's wrapped up into American society, but moments like Lou Gehrig or Jackie Robinson, Roberto Clemente, aren't quite as many as one would think. And this really seemed to be one where he was making a mark not just on the baseball world, but on the world at large, and felt like the right way to honor him and what he's given us.
Right. One very special moment in baseball history was the perfect game thrown by Don Larsen. And please describe the great photograph that is here that captures this moment on October 8th, 1956.
Yeah, one of the things I love about it, so it's he's in the arms of Yogi Berra, having just Don Larsen is having just finished his perfect game, and it shows you sort of what a big guy Don Larsen is, because Yogi wasn't tall, but Yogi was a big heavy catcher, and it's Don who's picking up Yogi Berra, so it gives you a sense. I think Larsen was about 6'4", and gives you a sense of his size and his strength. And you see people, security people, and everybody spilling onto the field and coming close to them. The Yankees are beginning to celebrate. The Dodgers' first base coach is turning to leave the field, and again, it captures a singular moment. Here was a case when one of the landmark games, you know, one of the 10 or 15 games that will go down as the all-time games in baseball history, there was a great picture of it, and it was a great moment. And Larsen, whose career otherwise might not have merited a telling in the overall story of baseball, but certainly through this October day in 1956, warranted being in there.
Absolutely. I want to mention that there are several photographs that have a local connection to our listeners. For instance, a really interesting picture of the Braves having just moved from Milwaukee to Atlanta, and that story is talked about. There's a great picture of the Kenosha Comets. They were one of the women's teams active during World War II and just after, along with the Racine Belles. But the photograph actually shows some talented women of the Kenosha Comets, and all kinds of wonderful photographs to take us up to the present day. I want to finish real quick by having you talk about a great photograph that is not on the field but in a restaurant. The headline says "The Art of the Craft," and the great Ted Williams is sitting down to a meal with two much younger players. Explain why this image is here. It is wonderful, but why did you want to include it?
You know, it's great that you bring this one up. I think of all these pictures, and when you live with them and look at them, I really love so many of them, and it's hard to choose. But in some ways, this is my favorite photograph, or the one that I think about sometimes when I'm away from the book, as much or more than any others. So it's Williams, as you said, and he's sitting at a lunch table in Florida during spring training of 1986, and he's there with Don Mattingly and Wade Boggs. And this is at the height of the time when Boggs is, you know, multiple time batting champion, and Mattingly is in the heart of his MVP caliber seasons, and they're staring at Ted, who's sort of in a half swing because he's talking hitting, and he's showing the way he turns on a pitch, and you can see the way his hands are on top of one another. It's just such an amazing picture about baseball going generation to generation. One beautiful detail of this is that Williams has a cloth napkin tucked over the front of his shirt to preserve his shirt, which is what men of his age and at that time period did. And the younger men aren't doing that, right? And it's just another detail which underscores the different generations, but they're together around baseball, and
you're
around
right.
This incredible thing.
And you can kind of see the reverence and respect that is on the faces of these young players sitting in the presence of one of the towering legends of the game. It really is a beautiful image. The whole book is wonderful. Again, it's titled "The Story of Baseball in 100 Photographs." This is published by Sports Illustrated, and the editor, Kostya Kennedy, also responsible for a really nice introduction for the book. Kostya Kennedy, you've done it again, and I thank you so much for joining me today on the morning show to talk about this wonderful book. Best wishes.
Oh, and to you. Thanks so much for having me on. This was really great. I appreciate the time, and so glad you've been enjoying the book.
tomorrow. I hope you can join me for the Friday morning show as we talk about the past,